It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we continue our Out in Wisconsin series with a conversation with two of the plaintiffs in the case challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage.
First, we look at the growing insurgency in Iraq. A militant group known as ISIS has been taking cities in the north of the country and is marching toward Baghdad as the Iraqi government scrambles to shore up its defenses.
The turmoil in Iraq has many looking to the United States to offer assistance. President Obama seems to have ruled out sending American troops back to the country, but is said to be weighing airstrikes.
Andrew Tabler joins us now. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Andrew, this militant group ISIS has come to prominence very quickly. What do we know about them?
ISIS was born in Iraq, but metastasized in the conflict in Syria. For the last 3 years, the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria has become destabilized, hasn't controlled its territory for about the same number of years, and over time grew up, particularly in the face of Western reticence to fund the opposition there. It took advantage of the situation, grew up, and then went back into Iraq where it was founded and has been carrying out the activities you've seen the last week.
And their movement through the country has been called lightning fast. What are we seeing so far as their movement and what cities they've been active in?
Lightning fast column advances with very limited troops, cutting through Iraqi military formations that the United States has spent billions of dollars propping up. Very, very, very problematic going forward, I think. First it pushed, of course, into Mosul, then to Tikrit, down to Samarra, and now is threatening the environs of Baghdad. We'll see where they'll move over the coming days, but very bad news for the Obama administration and the United States.
Do we know what their goals are?
Their goals are to set up an Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as the name says. It does not respect the boundaries of the region. It has a jihadist extremist ideology and it runs roughshod over society. It's actually so bad that Al-Qaeda cut it off as an affiliate in February of this year due to its tactics of beheading people and crucifying them. So you can imagine both on a strategic, in terms of strategic dimension, as well as ideologically, this is a big loss for the United States in Iraq and in Syria.
As you said, they've been moving quickly, and we haven't seen the Iraqi government able to stem their movement. Why is that? This is a militia, an army that the United States has trained, in effect. Why are they having so little effect?
Very good question. It basically comes down to the fact that we've bet our horses on the Maliki government in Iraq, which is increasingly dominated by one sect, the Shia, from which Mr. Maliki hails, and the majority in the country. They don't include Sunnis and Kurds in their governing structure, so to speak. They've been isolating them. So what's happened over time is the Sunni population, from which the ISIS group hails, has said, okay, we're going to claim back what is rightfully ours in the country. And that's what we see coming out before us in Iraq now. It's kind of like a regional sectarian war that is brewing in Iraq and Syria that's now manifesting itself in the activities in and around Baghdad right now.
Right. That's an interesting aspect of all of this. I've seen this described as turning Iraq into a state that's part of partition. We've got the Kurds and the Shiites and the Sunnis again. What does that mean as you look at it?
What it means is the United States continues to look at a map of the Middle East with the lines drawn almost 100 years ago by the French and the British, but people there have taken matters into their own hands. They're organizing according to sect, and they have active participation of groups that don't recognize these boundaries inside of Syria and Iraq. So the people there are choosing their own destiny and draw their own boundaries. Unfortunately, one group, ISIS, is diametrically opposed to the United States. The bad news is that the states that normally control this territory on the map, here we look at Maliki's government in Iraq and Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria, are not capable of controlling their own territory. And this is the reason why ISIS is before us today.
And we've been seeing Shiite resistance. At least I've seen reports of Shiites scrambling to join the Iraqi army and set up defense. Have you gotten any word about how that's moving forward so far?
It's not exactly clear, But while Shia forces are coming to the aid of the Maliki government, and one major cleric there, Cleric Sistani, today talked about a call to arms, the problem is that you can't shoot your way out of this crisis completely. The areas that have been retaken by ISIS are Sunni-controlled areas. Shia are not present there. So it's very difficult for the increasingly sectarian-based Maliki government to hold sway over all of Iraqi territory, and that's the problem we have in front of us right now, and we'll have in front of us in the coming weeks ahead.
Well, the United States is still weighing what to do in this situation. What are the options that are on the table, and what seems to be the most obvious answer as we go forward today?
Well, President Obama has, predictably, in his style, ruled out only what he will not do first, and that is will not send ground troops to Iraq. That's not exactly surprising, but what's unclear is, will he carry out airstrikes? Will there be drone strikes? Will there be support for the Iraqi forces in other ways on the ground? And how is he going to respond to Iran's increasing role inside of Iraq? This is extremely controversial, especially as we have nuclear negotiations with Iran, and complicates the matters considerably concerning getting Iran to give up its nuclear program, or at least to put it into mothballs.
Now, President Obama has been criticized in the last day or two for not supporting Syrian opposition, for pulling troops out in 2011. What do you make of the criticism and the damage that it could do?
Well, I think it's justified. Even those that have admired President Obama's ability to get around getting further involved in Syria seem to understand now that this cancer that was growing inside the region and grew up inside of Syria is now affecting a lot of U.S. assets. We spent a lot of money in Iraq, and now it's going down the drain, and it seems to be a result of neglect on the Syrian front. The problem we have is, in both Iraq and Syria, is that the increasingly sectarian-based Shia regimes in each country don't include Sunnis, and you can't reassert control over Iraq and Syria without more Sunni involvement. Until we do that and work more with particularly the moderate opposition inside of Syria, we're not going to have the hope of arresting this.
So in terms of who's arming ISIS, what do we know about that?
Primarily, support for ISIS comes from the Arab Gulf and other parts of the Middle East, but primarily from private individuals. But ISIS has an ability to be quite entrepreneurial. They actually, when they recapture area, they begin assessing taxes. They've even refined oil in eastern Syria and then sold it to the Bashar al-Assad regime, who are nominally their enemies, but the Assad regime buys petroleum products from them and refuses to attack them in exchange. So actually allows them to grow that much quicker and has sustained their hold on eastern Syria and now into Iraq over the coming last few months.
And can we assume that they're seizing assets from the Iraqi military as they have victories over them?
They do, and they have. And they've already moved those assets into Syria, where they have a lot of strategic depth going forward.
Now, as far as the United States and the action that we take going forward, is it an option for the United States to choose, you know, not to do anything? There's been a lot of debate nationally about too much interventionism. Is that an option here?
We haven't. Well, I don't think so at this point. It's hard. We haven't actually been intervening a lot in the Middle East at all. The president has a very low tolerance for risk. He doesn't want to get further involved in the Middle East. And then what happens is people there take matters into their own hands. And while that, you know, is something that some people say is inevitable, it's not going to stop oil prices from going up as a result of Iraqi production coming off of line or being threatened. It's not going to make al-Qaeda affiliates go away or jihadist organizations in general. And both of those things are not good news for the average American, and that is a threat to U.S. interests.
And Andrew, what will you be watching for in the coming days?
I think you should be watching for what does the United States actually do in Iraq? Does it tolerate more Iranian involvement there? And also, what does it do inside of Syria? You can't solve what's going on right now in Iraq without addressing what's going on in Syria. And many people, including the former ambassador Robert Ford to Syria, has said, look, the only way that you can clean up this problem among primarily from a Sunni-based group like ISIS is by dealing with Sunnis inside of Syria, moderate Sunnis, to get them to fight other more extremist Sunnis. And we'll have to watch what the president's decisions are on that in the coming days.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking about the latest in Iraq with Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This Sunday is Father's Day, and right now we're helping you get in the spirit.
Throughout the day today, we're hearing messages that our listeners left us during the week about the best advice they ever got from their dads. Here's another one of your stories.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Remick, and I think the best lessons I learned from my dad were he would say to me, you can do whatever you want to do, just do the best you possibly can. And I used to come up with some pretty wild ideas, like, hey, Dad, I'm going to be a bike racer. And I ended up doing just that and won a lot of championships, which was great. And he also said, I'm going to teach you girls how to change your oil in your car. Because you shouldn't have to depend on a man to run your car, which was funny because I ended up being really independent and definitely did change my oil back in the day. Don't do it now, but it was nice to know that I could do that. All right. Thanks for doing your Father's Day tribute. Bye.
And thank you, Rebecca. You can continue the conversation and share your stories over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, news guy Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a weekly look at the top state news stories of the week, including the same-sex marriage case we've been following since last Friday.
Now we're continuing our month-long Out in Wisconsin series. June is LGBT Pride Month, and on Fridays at this time throughout June, we are featuring stories from Wisconsin's LGBT community.
Last week, we talked to a young transgender girl and her mother about what it's like to be gender non-conforming in a small Wisconsin town. Today, we're speaking with two of the plaintiffs in the case challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage.
Last Friday, federal judge Barbara Crabb ruled that Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. That ruling stirred some confusion about whether marriages could begin immediately. By Friday evening, same-sex couples were marrying in Madison and Milwaukee. More licenses issued around the state now. And today, we're waiting to hear clarification from Judge Crabb on whether she will issue an injunction on Wisconsin's ban or a stay on her ruling.
That case was brought by the Wisconsin American Civil Liberties Union, along with eight couples. Cammie Young and Karina Wills are one of the couples, and they join us in our Milwaukee studio, along with the director of the ACLU Wisconsin, Chris Amity. Cammie and Karina, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Chris, it's good to have you along, too.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be back on Central Time.
So exactly a week ago at this time, Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban was unconstitutional. Cammie, where were you at that time, and what was your reaction?
I was actually at home. I am currently on maternity leave. I just had a young daughter about 3 months ago. So I was at home and enjoying all the wonderful Facebook posts that were going on at the time, which was great, very celebratory.
And what about you, Karina?
I was actually sitting at my desk at work and just, you know, I think I received a couple texts from Cammie telling me what was happening and just being very excited.
And did you have, were you thinking about the political picture and what that could mean, or were you thinking about, you know, your own situation, Cammie?
I don't think I was necessarily thinking of my own situation just because we are one of the two couples who are already married. So, you know, our viewpoint's a little bit different from some of the other plaintiffs. But I was just really elated for all of my friends who I knew would want to take advantage of this. And, you know, a lot of them have gone out already and started getting married, you know, Friday and Saturday. This morning was a witness for one of our other friends who decided to go ahead and get married. So it's just, you know, really happy for everyone and happy that, you know, this ruling came in the way it did.
Well, the two of you already married last December in Minnesota. Karina, how does it affect you, this ruling? How does it affect you personally?
Well, you know, I think the details are all, you know, still in limbo. I don't know exactly, I know exactly what I want to happen, and that is for me to be recognized as a parent to our daughter, because right now I'm not. My name wasn't added to her birth certificate. So I think what we'd like to have come out of this is for us to be recognized as a married couple and also for me to be a legal parent.
And Karina, in the eyes of the law in Wisconsin, you're not, as it stands right now, the legal parent of your daughter. How has that knowledge affected your relationship, or has it affected the way you feel as you go about your day-to-day life?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, part of me is always very hesitant to even call myself a parent because I know by the eyes of the law, I'm not. So it makes me angry. Even though Cammie and I went into the venture to get pregnant and have our daughter together as a couple, I'm still kind of an outsider. So it hurts.
Chris, we're going to go to you now. Last Friday, the ACLU advised its clients, those that have not yet married, that they should hold off and not get married Friday evening. Why was that?
Well, we recognize that we're all in this long haul, and things are going to work out. Things are going to be great because we're confident that not only public opinion but legal developments are on the side of ACLU and the clients and other couples who are out there who are married, considering getting married, and other people who just want to have the freedom to marry. You know, not everybody's going to get married, but like straight couples, they should have that choice. So we didn't feel that people had to rush into anything if they weren't prepared to do that. So what we're trying to achieve now is getting some clarity out of the court rulings and conveying that to couples all across Wisconsin and reassuring them that they can be confident that things are proceeding as the ACLU envisioned them proceeding in terms of filing and expedited proceedings. And we're going to get some good decisions. And, you know, it may not be this case that gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the basic reason the ACLU is doing this for couples and potential couples in Wisconsin is to give them a voice in the tremendous discussion that's going on in America about the rights of people in relationships that aren't necessarily traditional ones.
As we speak, we're waiting to hear if Judge Crabb will issue an injunction or a stay, waiting on that news, but because of this, the situation has been described as legal limbo. What do you make of that lack of clarity?
Well, as I said before, it's going to get sorted out. And sure, people have to be patient. There's a little doubt. There's a little anxiety. But, you know, if you read Judge Crabb's decision from last Friday, she declared the state constitutional ban on marriages except between one man and one woman to be discriminatory, to be in violation of equal protection of the laws under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And in doing that, if you go in and read her opinion, you see that she has taken an important legal step. In a case last June that the ACLU had at the U.S. Supreme Court, Windsor versus the United States, the court said that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act had a section that was discriminatory, but they didn't exactly fill in all the details. Well, Judge Crabb has gone in and advanced the legal arguments and said that I know this is going to sound like legal jargon because it is, but she said that LGBT couples have what's called heightened scrutiny. The government can't just deny them the liberty and equality that Judge Crabb talked about because they come up with any old reason. You've got to look at it more carefully. And so that's an important legal advance. And when you think where we've come since last June in that Windsor case to where we are now with so many courts chiming in with a great decision from Judge Crabb that, you know, unequivocally declares the state of Wisconsin constitutional provision and related laws unconstitutional, we're really seeing a lot of progress. But with all the commotion since last Friday and today, it may not seem, you know, it may be difficult to focus on all that tremendous progress, but it's there and it's going to continue. And, you know, the ACLU couldn't have done this without great clients, without support from the LGBT community, without great lawyers. So
we're gonna
it's going to happen.
We're going to have to leave it there for now. We're going to come back and keep talking with Chris Almody, director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Wisconsin. Also talking with Karina Willis and Cammie Young, plaintiffs in the case challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. This is part of our month-long Out in Wisconsin series.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Karina Willis and Cammie Young, two of the plaintiffs in the case challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. They're joined by ACLU Wisconsin Director Chris Almody. The conversation is part of our month-long Out in Wisconsin series.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions about Wisconsin's same-sex marriage court case for the couple or the ACLU Wisconsin? And how has this case, this judge's ruling, affected you? And let us know whether you agree or disagree with the ruling in the case. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Cammie, let's go back to you. Can you tell us some of the backstory here about how you and Karina first got involved in this case?
Well, I saw a post on Facebook by a friend of mine, and they were looking for someone in our situation who has was expecting, and so we gladly said that yes, we would love to join the case because we really thought it was important. So that's how we got involved in it, and we've been really enthusiastic through the whole process.
I'm going to go to the phones right now and take a call from Justin in Cross Plains. Hi, Justin.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to say that I wholeheartedly agree with the ruling. And a comment, I think that there's a fundamental philosophical misunderstanding with a lot of people that treat religious marriage and state marriage as the same thing, but it's the job of the state and of the country to protect everybody's rights. So if a man and a woman can get married, as far as the state's concerned, then so can a man and a man. It's no different than prohibiting somebody from, say, incorporating a business because, you know, the board consists of men and women or all men. And that's it. I'll listen for comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Justin. And Chris, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I think Justin brings up a really important point here because there is so much confusion about this. And, you know, the ACLU supports religious liberty. We support religious freedom. So if the government were to start to tell a religious institution, a church or synagogue, mosque, whatever, who they may marry and who they may not marry, we'd be the first ones to object because religious institutions can have doctrine about marriage, and as long as it doesn't harm people, you know, that's their free exercise of religion. But a lot of people get confused about this. There's been some reaction to the decision from people like Milwaukee Archbishop Listecki that sort of add to that confusion. But ACLU and our clients and the people that want equality and justice for all couples aren't trying to take anything away from religious institutions. Rather, we want to have our clients and same-sex couples share in what heterosexual couples already have, the freedom to marry.
And Karina, I want to go back to you now. You and Cammie have been together for 13 years, and yet in the past several years, especially the last one or two, we've seen it referred to as a groundbreaking era in terms of the advancement of gay rights. Have you seen attitudes towards you and your partner change over the last several years? Have you seen that?
Oh, certainly. Even in my day-to-day job where I work, I think, you know, I've had the luxury of working at an organization that's you know, offers benefits to same-sex couples as they do married couples or heterosexual couples. And it's been a pretty open environment. I've been open pretty much since the day that I started working there. But the openness has increased, I think, over the last couple of years tremendously. I remember, you know, even 10 years ago being afraid of talking about my partner or, you know, our family and things like that. And it has become a lot more positive just in the last couple of years.
And Cammie, what about you?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. You know, I definitely don't have a problem whatsoever and pretty much never have telling people about, you know, my life and what's going on with it. I don't beat around the bush about it, but I would say that the reactions from people have gotten better and, you know, they have just really been able to embrace us like normal people. So we're not just, you know, something of an oddity anymore. We're more of a an inclusion into the community.
Now, it's worth pointing out that what happened on Friday with Judge Crabb is a ruling or a decision made by one federal judge. It doesn't, by necessity, change the way society responds. What do you see, Karina, as the next steps in making Wisconsin a place that is more accepting of the LGBT community?
Well, I think the most important thing is, you know, getting the laws changed and making sure that all LGBT people have equal opportunity to the rights that our laws afford us. I think that making that change and moving along will definitely help LGBT people feel, I don't know how to say it, maybe more not more proud, but more accepting of themselves even, because I think LGBT people often have even problems accepting themselves because of how other people view them. So the first step is definitely changing the law and making sure that our government views us on equal terms.
There's certainly a back and forth when you talk about the relationship to of the law and societal attitudes. It would be hard to imagine the civil rights movement without the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which declared segregation illegal and unconstitutional. It would be hard to think of the civil rights movement, or our case for that matter, without the decision in Loving versus Virginia, where the court declared that interracial marriage was unconstitutional. So, yes, societal issues change, and maybe that gives judges a little more willingness to go forward and take the next step. But then the cases themselves, you know, there's like almost a symbiotic relationship. Some people get caught up talking about polling and all that, and that's important. But I think that we've heard already that equally important is the relationship between the law and societal attitudes. And we shouldn't underestimate the importance of people coming out to their friends and families and at their workplaces, because I think one reason why things have changed so dramatically in a way that judges will now consider these kinds of cases is that once somebody knows somebody who's gay or lesbian, it makes them think differently about it. And particularly if it's a loved one, it's really hard unless you're willing to, you know, cut them off. And of course, that has happened. But it really makes people think differently about it. So from the individual acts of LGBT people reaching out and interacting with their families and friends to societal attitudes, it all comes together and reinforces what's happening in terms of legal developments. And then there's a loop, and the legal developments spur on what's happening in society.
Now, we're just talking about same-sex marriage in the context of history alongside the civil rights movement. Karina, do you see what is happening here in Wisconsin with you and your partner as historic? Do you feel that you're part of history?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. In fact, on Saturday morning, I took the time to read the full 88-page ruling that Judge Crabb released on Friday. And as I read it, I got very emotional over it because, you know, our names are associated with something that is going to change the way that people look at us, and us being all of the LGBT community. And it's a tremendous honor to be part of this. I almost see this as, you know, there's different stages to, I guess, acceptance. There's first tolerance. You know, first people have to come to tolerate LGBT community. And I think that that will happen with the changing law. And then once people get more comfortable with with tolerating people, then they can come to actually accept us as equals. So I think it's going to be a long struggle, but this is a very historic first step.
Well, Karina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Cammy, thank you to you.
Thank you for having us.
And Chris, a pleasure to have you along with us as well.
Thank you and your listeners.
We've been speaking with Karina Wills and Cammy Young, two of the plaintiffs in the case challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. They've also been joined by ACLU Wisconsin Director Chris Amini.
This conversation is part of our month-long Out in Wisconsin series. June is LGBT Pride Month. On Fridays at this time during the month, we are featuring stories from the state's LGBT community. Noah Ovshinsky joins us in the studio for his weekly look at the top news in Wisconsin. He's our assistant news director here at WPR. And we'll get an update, if any, on the ongoing court and county clerk news in the same-sex marriage case. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, we're watching this ruling. This could be a real-time conversation, a ruling from Judge Barbara Crabb. What are we waiting for today?
Well, we're expecting a ruling literally at any minute now from Judge Crabb. And just as a reminder, she ruled Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional last week. She's going to hopefully further clarify what she wants the state to do now that she has ruled it unconstitutional, and perhaps more importantly, decide whether or not to stay her ruling. And if she decides to stay her ruling, that means same-sex marriage will end in Wisconsin, at least for the time being.
So let's nail down the legal terms. A stay means I've ruled it unconstitutional, but don't do anything with it just yet until it gets further clarified.
Yes, exactly.
And we've heard the word injunction bouncing around. Check me on this. An injunction would mean, hey, now the state's ban is over. Go for it, people. Is that close to
right?
Well,
yes and no. So one thing she could do is issue an injunction. So she could further clarify what she meant by the ruling by issuing an injunction, basically stopping the state officials from enforcing the gay marriage ban.
Okay.
Right? Then she would issue a stay of that ruling. Meaning gay marriage for right now would be suspended pending an appeal, which the state is most certainly going to pursue.
So in theory, this ruling might end this sort of state of limbo we've been in this week. So it was vague, and people have read this in different ways, including really important people like county clerks.
Right. So in her initial ruling last week, Judge Crabb was a bit vague as to whether or not same-sex couples could get married. I mean, she ruled it unconstitutional, but wasn't very specific beyond that. And since then, an increasing number of clerks across the state have allowed it. The state's Department of Vital Records are processing the paperwork. All the while, State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen has maintained that these marriages are still illegal under the law.
So I don't want to get you into the prediction game, but what's the prevailing wisdom? What do we expect here?
I think there's a good chance, and from Judge Crabb's comments in the courtroom, I think strongly suggest that she is going to issue a stay of her ruling, whatever that ruling might be. The reality is, and she even acknowledged this, that, you know, judges at her level across the country have issued stays in order to prevent, you know, confusion and the legal limbo that can result from these challenges sort of making their way through the legal system. And frankly, in cases where judges haven't issued the stays, judges further up the judicial ladder have done it for them, the appeals courts as well as the Supreme Court itself.
And she is not, and she's mentioned, not the highest level here.
No. And in fact, you know, whatever happens today, this is likely going to land in the hands of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago and potentially beyond.
And what about the state's side of this? They've been defending the state's constitutional amendment, the same-sex marriage ban. What are we hearing from the Attorney General's office?
Right. So J.B. Van Hollen has essentially maintained since the ruling last week that it is illegal. One of the things that Judge Crabb said in her initial ruling was she wanted to maintain the status quo. The problem is people interpreted that differently. J.B. Van Hollen and other state officials interpret that as being the status quo being the ban in effect. Mm-hmm. Clerks, as well as people who are supporting gay marriage in the state, interpreted that ruling as the new status quo. That is to say, the status quo now that the marriage ban is unconstitutional. And so that's where a lot of that confusion is. But the Attorney General still maintains that the status quo is, in fact, the ban's still in effect.
And if this goes back and forth, one thing that'll have to be sorted out is people who have marriage licenses signed in their pockets. Right.
What happens? What does that mean? Is it legal? Is it not legal? And I think right now that's still a very big question mark.
Well, in the months running up to this, we've been hearing a steady drumbeat of stories, a court ruling in this state or three states at a time. Are there comparable cases out there that we in Wisconsin might look toward?
Right. So there are. Just as J.B. Van Hollen will likely appeal this case to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, there are other circuits, appeals courts, that are considering similar cases across the country. And in fact, the Fourth Circuit, as well as the Tenth Circuit, could actually hand down rulings in those gay marriage cases in the next few months. So I think people are interested in sort of figuring out what the future is of gay marriage as far as the courts are concerned. I think could probably look to those rulings as at least a short-term answer. Of course, everybody thinks this eventually will, many people think, I should say, think this will eventually end up with the Supreme Court anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think people who are interested in seeing where gay marriage is going to go in this country can certainly look at those rulings, which are expected in the next few months.
Well, here's a non-update. Scott Bauer from the AP tweets that Judge Crabb's office says still working on it.
Yep, still working on it. So no news.
We'll be watching for that the rest of the evening. Well, moving on to another story. It got big. We talked about it here on the show. May have turned around a controversy over cheese and health.
Right. So this is a story that has, for now at least, resolved itself, mm-hmm. but nonetheless made headlines across the country, and especially here in Wisconsin. The FDA cited a few cheesemakers in New York for using wooden boards to ripen cheese. And at the time, they said that this process was unsanitary and seemed to suggest that they weren't going to allow cheesemakers to use wood boards to age cheese.
And this, and I learned this in the course of this topic coming out, there's a lot of cheese being aged on wooden boards in our state right now.
A lot. In fact, according to cheese folks, there's currently around 30 million pounds, right? 30 million pounds of cheese aging on wooden boards as we speak in the state of Wisconsin.
We'll get into the FDA's decision a bit, but there was a lot of reaction here in Wisconsin to this.
I mean, it was a firestorm, frankly. I mean, this was a technique that cheesemakers have been using for more than a century to make certain and very popular kinds of cheese. You know, the FDA's actions were surprising to me and to other people in two really big ways. One is there was no evidence that anybody's actually gotten sick from consuming a product that was aged on a wooden board. And the FDA went after cheesemakers in New York, even though the state itself, like here in Wisconsin, allows the practice of aging cheese on wood.
So what did we hear from state officials, elected?
Absolutely.
And so on?
Ben Brantzel, the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection here in the state, wrote a letter to the agency strongly urging them to rethink their stand on wooden boards. Governor Walker also issued a statement on the issue. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Congressman Mark Pocan, all of them weighing in on this wood board issue.
So what do we hear from the FDA since then? That was earlier this week.
Yeah. So fast forward like a day or two, and the FDA, after obviously getting an earful from a variety of stakeholders, backed off a bit and said while they are still concerned about the safety of wood boards, they weren't going to, you know, change the rules at this point, meaning all of that 30 million pounds of cheese aging currently in Wisconsin is still aging and will hopefully be consumed.
And a cheese artisanal cheese advocate on the show said they looked at research that was worried about the cheese. They say there's research showing, hey, this is safe, and they want the FDA to check that out.
Right, exactly. The sicknesses that do come from cheese consumption, you know, most people think that it's not actually from the wooden boards themselves. It's from unsanitary practices in general that can lead to those kinds of sicknesses. It's not traced directly back to the actual use of wooden boards. In fact, it's the wooden boards themselves that give this cheese the flavor and character that they have.
Well, that's one. If it crops up again, I'm sure we'll be covering it again in the future if the FDA modifies its position permanently or comes back on with this enforcement. Well, one more story we wanted to get to that's gotten a lot of attention. You said a lot of people are checking this out on the WPR News website. Black flies in northern Wisconsin.
Right. So there's been an outbreak of black flies in northern Wisconsin. And unfortunately, it's causing loons, the ever popular loons, to abandon their eggs.
Right. This is sad. I mean, so black fly is not an unexpected thing to see in northern Wisconsin, but this is worse than your average year.
Right. It's worse because certainly because of the timing, because all of these loons are now on their nests, but also because of the long winter that we had, as well as the spring that we have. Experts say around 70% of the nests in northern Wisconsin have been abandoned because of these black flies. An expert quoted by Glenn Moberg in a story that we aired earlier this week said it was the worst he'd seen in 22 years.
So a long winter, they're blaming. What are the specifics there? I know you're not a trained entomologist.
I'm not. Although the experts tell me that it's the late snow melt that is really to blame. Essentially, a long winter followed by a late spring. There's a lot of water on the ground, and bugs love water.
And it's bothering the loons, and that's sad. I know we'll be watching that. And did you get a sense from Glenn how humans are reacting to the black flies up there? Is it pretty bad?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. The other thing, too, that's really benefited from the really hard winter that we had are mosquitoes. Apparently, the mosquitoes are really bad right now in northern Wisconsin. According to experts, the conditions were just right for a really big hatch. That snowy winter in combination with a quick warm up and lots of rain made essentially for a perfect storm when we talk about mosquitoes, black flies, that sort of thing.
And that was kind of a hope crusher because the hope was we survived this really cold winter. Maybe the cold will cut back on the mosquitoes some. But as we've heard on this show from mosquito experts, that blanket of snow came down fast enough to where the cold didn't even touch the mosquitoes.
No, they lived and they're out and,
all right.
and invading northern Wisconsin.
All right. Noah, thanks so much. And we're still watching for that decision from Judge Crabb, clarifying last week's decision on same-sex marriage. We'll be listening for it on WPR News.
Yep. Thanks.
That's Noah Ovshinsky. He's our news guy, officially assistant news director at WPR. He joins us each Friday at this time to round up the top state news stories of the week.